missing a commissioner. Just when you thought it was safe. Since we now have a full complement, get it back underway. Mr. Barr, can I ask you first, I think I know what the answer to this question is. Your 3.1, you call the process we're engaged in a review of the operative district plan. My understanding, effectively, from the following series of paragraphs, that it's not actually a review, it's a plan change. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page.
Yes, that's correct.
Which is why Ms. Scott was telling us what motor machinists says about plan changes and the scope thereof. 3.7. I've read the paragraph you cross-refer in Derby, and I want you to explain how you get the proposition you say you express in the first sentence, 3.7, because to be frank, I think it says the opposite. I'm reading from it. Reading from paragraph 7. An aspect is the incorporation of the proposed chapter 3. ODP presently has chapter 4 on district-wide matters. However, that chapter does not operate as an overarching strategic directions chapter. So I'm interested as to how you draw from that that chapter 3 is replacing chapter 3 as the overall strategic chapter is replacing chapter 4. Of the ODP.
Hopefully it's more about the content matter of what's in part four or part four of the operative plan. Part four of the operative plan has district-wide issues, objectives and policies, but it's not strategic. The balance, an example of that, I think, is in, if you've needed to go there, part 7 of the operative plan actually has district-wide objectives and policies on urban growth and the distribution of urban settlements. So the operative plan has a different, very different structure, and part 4 of the operative plan, like I said, shouldn't be or has necessarily been treated as a strategic chapter in the same way that the proposed district plan strategic chapter is. The balanced land that remains, hopefully this is relevant to your question, but in many respects too, as we've worked our way through an analysis of part 4 of the operative plan, the parts that remain applicable to the outstanding operative parts, the special zones, are relatively limited and have been overtaken, especially when it comes to the policy framework for outstanding natural landscapes and rural landscapes.
I suppose the question would be, like, one of the aspects that I read the Environment Court as being critical of the process is that Council has advanced a series of plan changes, as we're now clear it is, but it's not at all clear what actually is being changed.
Because there were no operative provisions struck out with the
because the plan change did not actually say which operative provisions would cease to apply.
Mm.
And so my follow-up question was going to be, was the second sentence the Environment Court's view or your view? It's 3.7 of Mr. Barr's evidence.
What was the question? Yeah, can you just repeat the question? Sorry, sir.
It's really, is that where it's, you've said all objectives in Section 4 are being replaced,
mm-hmm.
With two exceptions. Is that your view or the court's view?
That's my view. That's my view, and that was confirmed by the court in the Topic 1 decision. It was probably always naively my view in terms of the council notifying what it called a proposed district plan in 2015. But I'm not going to disagree with the technicalities of the Topic 1 decision.
Yeah, wise man.
It's the second interim decision on Topic 1. So it's the Derby planning decision, which is in tab 5 of the case book. Attached to that decision are the council's legal submissions on this, which were accepted by the court.
So that's, you say, tab 5.
Yes.
All right. And so when, in your view, will Section 4 of the ODP entirely fall away? After this process is complete, or is it still live for some purposes?
It'll still remain live for the purposes, of the two objectives that are identified in my strategic evidence. One of them relates to natural hazards, and the other one relates to affordable housing. So part 4 will fall away for the most part when chapters 3, 4, and 6 of the PDP are, for want of a better word, confirmed, either confirmed by the court or made operative by the council.
When there's no longer any land in Schedule B, any land the subject of Schedule B?
No, it'll be when those provisions in those chapters I mentioned are confirmed. There'll still be land in Schedule B. That land, so chapters 3 to 6 of the PDP will apply to that land. But only, particularly where it engages with the landscape issue, only to the extent that an unanticipated activity is applied for in a resource consent or notice of requirement context.
Okay. Can you satisfy my curiosity? At 5.11, I know it's not relevant to this hearing, but as sitting here, you get the chance to ask questions to satisfy your curiosity. Where is Area A on Mount Iron that the court found was not part of the ONF?
It's the area that is northernmost, and it's not the two slithers of land that was zoned low-density residential that had a sort of weaving pattern with the urban growth boundary. It's actually a slightly larger parcel of land to the north at the base of the hill, and it's the area identified as essentially a square sort of square shape, and it's got urban zoning on two sides of it. It's about just under 10. Actually, I can't tell you the size of it, sorry, but it was involved in it in terms of the appeal, but it's around, it's a couple of hectares, I think. If you walk up the Mountain Trail from the Dock car park where most people walk up,
yeah.
As you head up the hill, it's the land that's sort of in front of you and adjoins that, the urban development that exists already. As you sort of start to head up the hill before you take your first sort of turn around to the right, I don't know if that helps or not from your memory of probably walking up the hill.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. You're talking about the colonial vineyard, and you produced an appendix. There's a red line in the appendix, and I was wondering whose that was, where like an underlined change.
That was a track change comment that was made during the process, and it probably didn't need to be shown as a track change comment, but for want of nothing else, at least it showed that the author was reading what was there, and it just showed a nuance with the relationship with this district and the national planning standards.
So that's your amendment, yeah. Thank you. And I wanted to ask you about your 6.7, which is the application, the council's approach to the NPS UDC. You said the council's approach to the Wanaka urban environment is comprising Wanaka, Albertown, Luggett and Lake Hawea Township. You and I may have had this discussion before. The question I had is, how do you get to that position given the definition of urban environment in the NPS? Not so much how does it extend out there, but if it extends out there, how come it doesn't apply to the bits between the outlying settlements and Wanaka? That's the issue I'm interested in, given the definition.
I can't remember my answer to this in 2018, but my answer today is because the NPS UDC, with the exception of the definition of urban development, which is very broad and just says an area of land containing or intended to contain a concentrated settlement of 10,000 people, essentially leaves it up to the local authority to identify what that urban environment is and how that urban environment might be shown spatially and also planned or provided for through its district plan. So because of the geographic and landscape constraints of the Upper Clutha, the council in deciding to include those four areas as the sum of its parts is really a product of that, rather than other urban environments, which another local authority might be able to more easily distinguish different urban environments where they would have been separated. But for the case of this district, that's the decision, or that's the way it's been handled.
Can you point out to me, when you say the NPS leaves it up to the local authority, which provisions you mean? And if you can't put your hand on them right now, then don't pour all over them. If you just come back to me at some convenient moment this week.
Yes.
And the other question I had arising also out of 6.7, in terms of councils treated like it as part of the Wanaka urban environment, how and where is it defined the boundary of Luggett for this purpose?
I'd have to probably dive into the section 32 for the settlements, which I don't have in front of me. We probably don't have the time for me to try to find the answer in that.
Can you write that down as a to revert? Here you're talking about the consent order that's now been made by Judge Jackson. The question I had is, has anybody in the PDP appeal process suggested that there is a need to reopen the matters resolved in the Topic 2 interim decision arising out of the outcome of the RPS?
No.
Good answer. In terms of the discussion in Judge Jackson's minutes about those introductory words and his concerns that they might or might have enabled an overall decision, were you among those who were of the opinion that they didn't?
You mean that the text might have still entertained an overall broad judgment,
yes,
application of provisions? No, or else the QLDC probably wouldn't have agreed to those provisions as a 274 party. That's an aside, but I think
you mean yes.
In terms of agreement with the judge?
No. The question was, we'll reframe it,
yeah,
we'll put it again. Were you among those who thought it didn't give rise to an overall broad judgment?
Yes, I was.
And given that, what it says is all objectives and policies to be given effect. Some of the objectives and policies, there are assigned priorities, but for those that are not, if there are conflicting objectives in the RPS, what happens then? If there's no broad judgment to resolve the difference, how is that conflict resolved?
It would depend on how that particular provision is provided, how that particular provision is applied in that context, and if there's specificity or sufficient particularisation as to how the provisions apply, there would need to be an assessment made in that context without resorting to part two, so to speak. You would need to try to find a way to reconcile the tension within that document.
So, in effect, you'd apply the instruction in King Salmon. You'd see which is the more directive and hope that you,
yes,
resolve the tension that way.
Yes.
Point 8.7a. This actually arises in Mr. Dicey's evidence, because he says, as a paraphrasing, that for the likes of Cadrona Cattle Club seeking an industrial zone over Gibson Character Zone land, you need to have regard to the objectives of the Gibson Character Zone. And I wrote in large letters in my margin, why? The point for you, the way you put it, is where you've said whether the change is consistent with the objectives and policies of the proposed zone, which proposed zone? The zone proposed in the PDP or the zone that the submitter is proposing when they're seeking a rezoning?
I think for the purposes of how A was written, 8.7A was written, it was probably in the context of the proposed zone. But having said that, I think the objectives and policies of the existing zone are just as relevant to the extent that a particular resource might require protection under that existing zone framework.
I think that the way that in previous stages the hearing panel resolved that was to say that if someone was seeking a wholly new zone or different zone, then you'd go back to the strategic direction in the plan. Because by definition, if the submitter was competently advised, then of course the objective, then what they're proposing is going to be consistent with the objectives and policies they've drafted for themselves, because they will have written it around what they want to do.
Particularly with the case where a new zone's proposed and the zone is being pursued by the submitter. I think LeMay, in hindsight, was definitely written in the context of an existing PDP zone, and whether or not the question is, does the outcome or what the submitter is seeking to achieve meet the objectives and policies for that zone?
Now, I wanted to ask you some questions or see if you can help me understand where either the parties or the court or both have got to on the strategic chapters. I'm not suggesting you need to defend what's there, because I know you may not even agree with what's there, but I just want you please to try and help me understand what you think it means. The first point is in 3.1b2. On page 3.2, I was interested in the concepts of no fixed hierarchy. Does that mean that there's a movable hierarchy? What does the word fixed mean, do you think?
It's probably emphasising, or if there's a fault there, it's over-emphasising the relationship between Chapter 3 and the balance of the plan. And that.
So it doesn't mean anything,
doesn't
it's just,
mean,
just the emphasis.
That's right.
Next question is the definition of landscape capacity. The word compromising, without compromising its identified landscape values, and again, similar in point two. How do you interpret the word compromising in this context? Like I think about, you talk about no compromise, which would suggest no adverse effects. Is that what it means? And if it means some adverse effect, what scale of adverse effect are we talking about?
I think it needs to be read in the context of the sentence, which says, without compromising its identified landscape values. So the values are the sum of all those constituent parts that make up the landscape. And so without overly focusing on the word compromise as to whether it means no change, or if it's a word that can tolerate change within a certain spectrum or effect, it comes back to the broader context as to the reference to landscape values in one. And two is essentially the same, where it still talks about compromising in the context of quite a broad construct of landscape values.
I suppose, I'll put it another way. At what point is a value or a series of values compromised?
That would depend on how those values are articulated or described in the district plan, which they will be moving forward, and it all comes back to how the supporting methods like rules and assessment matters and also policies articulate what in what situation or at what effect a resource is likely to be compromised. So I think you need to take guidance from the policy framework that's directly applicable to that scenario.
Which isn't still in the process of being worked out, as I understand it.
It is for the scheduling, certainly. In terms of the policy framework, if for certain zones, Chapter 6 and the substantive changes to policies in Chapter 3 that relate to, let's say, the rural zone does have some substantive decisions made on them.
Certainly.
The scheduling that's to be done will identify the particular values of each area.
Yes.
Amalgamated. Will it also identify the particular threats against that might compromise those values, or is it just going to...
There's a distinction. The guidance or the direction, without reading the nuances of the Environment Court's decision, the drafting that's been provided to date lends some guidance there. I think for the ONL and ONF, it's identifying values. With the rural character landscape, I think it's gone a step further. The direction from the Environment Court went a step further and talks about capacity and also threats. So for the rural character landscape areas, I think my reading of it at the moment is that you'd expect to see slightly more nuanced schedules about potential threats, perhaps also opportunities for enhancement, given that you're talking about an amenity landscape. I don't quite see that at the moment in the ONL, ONF direction that's been added to Chapter 3.
But at least by identifying the values, you have a better chance of being able to identify what might compromise them.
That's right, what the threats are and what activities might compromise them.
It's just the scale of the threat that leads to a compromise might be more... If I think that's what she was saying, at what point does a minor change become a compromise? This is a significant adverse effect, which might clearly be a compromise.
Well, I think my first answer is probably still quite helpful, and it depends on the sensitivity of the environment that whatever could compromise it could occur. So,
will that be determined through this?
Yes.
Values identification process.
Yes, it will, and also through the scheduling itself. The schedules will, if there's, let's say, it could be relatively broad landscape areas identified, there might end up being sort of 20 areas within one broader landscape catchment, and there'll be identification of the sensitivities of that area.
Within an ONL?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it'll be more than just a list of values for the whole row now. It'll be to hone in and look at the sensitivities within.
That's something that needs to be worked through as part of the conferencing and finalisation of the provisions, but my reading of the decision is that that is where it would go. It would, rather than be a very broad schedule on a very large area with multiple, I think it would be at the level of different types of landscape units perhaps within a broader landscape. Yeah.
Obviously you can't predict where the conferencing is going to go, but that's your reading of where the court wants it to go.
That's mine, yes.
And is that the same, similar level of detail as was done for the Wakatipu Basin, for example?
It could be. Yeah, it could be.
Going on to the definition of to 3217, I was intrigued by the fact that A talks about the protection of the landscape values, whereas everywhere else seems to be very clear that it's the scheduled values, not like I read that as all values, whereas everywhere else it seems like the provisions are clear that the relevant values are going to be the ones that are scheduled. Have I got that? Do you think I've got that wrong, or is this just something that might have slipped through the net?
Yeah, this, I'm not sure if I agree with you, but in any case, all policies will be for land. Not all rural zoned ONF land is going to be scheduled. This 3217 obviously applies the entire rural area. Just comparing your question, I'm just comparing it to some other provisions. 325. I hadn't quite picked up on that subtlety that perhaps with that objective there's a slightly different tone in that it wouldn't apply to scheduled areas.
So you compare 325XX where you either it's the identified values or the values that you get through application of a process, whereas this seems to be wide open.
Could have been drafted that way for efficiency, so it's encompassing of the more nuanced objective for 325XX in relation to land that's scheduled and land that's not scheduled but going to be subject to a methodology.
So, a definite maybe.
A definite maybe, sir. not something I've picked up on, is that being a different direction in terms of the application of that?
The next is a bit easier. Can you tell me what in a sustainable way means in 3219?
No, and I can't dodge that because I was in the room for the council at the time. Except to say it's still before the Environment Court, so they might have a similar question, and I'll want to drag things on. I might just say I can't think of it. I can't think of a way why that is the most appropriate way to phrase that right now.
Understood. I'm well aware that sitting in a conferencing room, things after the fifth hour, things, you know, tend to slide past you, and you think afterwards about them, reflect at leisure. Again, going back to 325XX, this is a discussion we have had before. Those values are protected. So we've identified there's a process in both of those for identifying which values. Those values are protected. To what extent? I can recall going round and round the houses with, I think, you and any number of other planners about, is this absolute protection? And if it's not absolute protection, protected to what extent? And I also know that the court didn't think much of our solution, which is, of course, the court's prerogative. But what does the end result mean? Has this moved to absolute protection in your view?
No. If it was absolute protection, the court wouldn't have used that. I think the court were probably more comfortable to use that word protect, not just because it reflects Section 6B, but with the additional support in the PDP with scheduling of values, it would help articulate perhaps where protection might need to be absolute in some places. And where a higher level of effects are permissible while still protecting those values from a landscape, or at least a landscape unit perspective.
So this comes back to the previous discussion. The schedule's going to assist in identifying what the trigger is in the scale of effects.
Yes.
I couldn't figure out how this would work. What does the words "are anticipated" mean? What is this getting at? Does this mean they're accepted? Is anticipated a synonym for accepted?
I think it is in the context of this, the preamble to that objective, yes.
And how does that coincide with maintaining landscape character? You say, on the one hand, you accept there are going to be adverse effects on landscape character, but landscape character must be maintained. How does that work?
I think it firstly goes back to not treating the word "maintain" as a no-change phrase, especially in its context for Section 7C of the Act. And I think it's, given that we have, at least when this decision was written, the majority of where the rural character landscapes are located, which is in the Upper Clutha Basin, those priority areas were going to be scheduled. So that probably gave further articulation as to anticipating what the potential effects are, and it comes back to the Commission's question about what threats might be as well, and having them articulated in the plan.
Going on to 3.2.54, how close is in proximity?
Further than adjacent?
Yeah, that much I figured out for myself.
Depends on the nature and scale of what's proposed as well. Proximity could be quite a way away, depending on what's proposed, depending on the effect of what's proposed.
So basically, it's sort of circular. If you're close enough to have an effect, you're in proximity.
Yes. And I think that may well have been the, at least the my my understanding of the court's discussion on the, on that related policy as well.
Now, turning to 338, this is a subject that I think Ms. Mann talks about in her evidence for, I think it's Tussock Rise, but she points out the decision of Judge Jackson's court in relation to Bunnings, where the judge was pretty clear, the judge and his court were pretty clear that they thought that that provision was contrary to the NPS UDC, but it doesn't seem to have been, I couldn't see any mention of even the issue, actually a response. Can you assist?
I don't think it was appealed, that policy, 338, we're talking about avoid
non-industrial. Well, that might be why it's not in the decision.
I don't think it was appealed.
And it, has it gone through on the nod? Because it wasn't...
I don't remember any passing comment. Ms. Scott was counsel in the hearing. I wasn't there for the whole thing. I don't remember any passing comment about the validity of that policy.
Yes, going to leave us with an interesting issue. Oh, yeah. 3336. Again, this may have been one of these things that comes out of conferencing. The while managing its adverse effects, what does that mean? What is the course of action?
Well, hopefully it's not an afterthought to the provision of the to the provision of the functional needs for infrastructure to locate within sensitive environments. It means that, in my view, it means that the acknowledgement of the functional needs is one thing, but it doesn't reduce or diminish the obligation to manage effects and still achieve other more environmentally focused outcome or more sort of policies with environmental bottom lines around regionally significant infrastructure.
So, for instance, it doesn't cut across the O&L policies for...
Not as it relates to regionally significant infrastructure. Regionally significant infrastructure itself cuts across the O&L policies, which is a product of the outcome of the RPS. So my answer there was qualified to the policies that apply to regionally significant infrastructure in Chapter 6. As it relates to landscapes, that policy is quite broad. It obviously relates to natural character and biodiversity provisions as well, which sit in Chapter 3 and the respective district-wide chapters.
So I suppose, does regionally significant infrastructure have to, as you put it, not compromise the values of an O&L?
I'll take you to the policy that relates to that for O&Ls, and it's at page 66, so same appendix to my strategic evidence in page 6 of the landscape chapter. And policy 6362 says that where it's demonstrated that that infrastructure can't avoid adverse effects on outstanding natural features and landscapes, avoid significant adverse effects so as to maintain the values that contribute to the outstanding nature and remedy or mitigate. So that looks a bit like regional policy statement policy 324. as well. So that's the key policy really for regionally significant infrastructure locating in those environments. The other policies still apply and they're probably helpful, but
That does delay, as you say, that's the more specific provision.
That's dead right, so that will prevail.
But just looking at it cold, that looks to me to be consistent with the main O&L policy.
Which is, you mean the back to 325 or in chapter 6?
Yeah, 325. Like, it's not obviously inconsistent, at least in my eye.
No, and if it's any benefit to the hearings panel, this was mediated in maybe December 2018, and the Topic 2 interim decision was released a year later. So the Environment Court probably hasn't even turned its mind to some of these provisions highlighted grey in the purple text, and they might have some questions about that, of course, and obviously there might be some inconsistencies, which the parties will probably get a chance to reconvene and discuss if they get asked to.
That's great. And yes, can you go to page 6-4? Policy 6331B, where it says, in the case of any subsequent subdivision, and I was thinking, subsequent to what?
Good question, sir. Subsequent to failure to achieve limb A, perhaps, or not?
Not sure. Yeah, you seem to be reaching in, and like as I said at the outset, I'm not asking you to defend, but to try and help me understand what this might mean.
Yes, it's good. It's interesting. If want of a better phrase to answer the question, sir. It's the first question, first time anyone's put that to me. I think it could be in the context of, irrespective of the strictness of the preamble and A, it could be that if notwithstanding that, you applied to, an application was applied for, was made. It's probably a word that was looked past relative to the tests at the end of the sentence. I think that's where the focus was. And if it helps, but it won't help, the drafting from the planners didn't include the word subsequent.
Didn't include.
Mm-hmm. It's probably the best answer I can give you.
Because A and B are conjunctive. I mean, that's got the and there. So B can't really be read as being an alternative to A, can it?
No, I hadn't read it till then, until this word subsequent was put in front of me. The focus has always been on the test at the back, and it's the court's drafting, it's the word subsequent.
I mean, so if it just said in the case of subdivision or development, it would mean what you think it means.
Or could mean.
Could mean.
It is what it is, as they say. I was intrigued by 6351, which is has an as far as practicable qualifier.
Yes, now that comes back to Yes, that's addressing, it's reflecting the functional needs for activities and structures to locate on the surface or the margins of water bodies. It also probably reflects, which isn't in my appendices, but the concept of where practical was added to a strategic objective for topic four, which was biodiversity, and around an objective around natural character.
Where I'm coming from is that virtually all of the waterways that are big enough to have a jetty or ferry transport are either O&Ls or O&Fs.
That's right.
So.
Yeah, the word practical there is acknowledging the constraints that an operator would have by not having an option to seek to avoid or to locate outside of that resource.
I can understand the argument. I suppose Ms. Scott puts it, describes these O&L provisions as bottom lines, and this is a fudge.
Yes, yeah.
A fudgy bottom line. Thank you very much for Mr. Barr. Really appreciate that. I've been puzzling over these provisions as to what they mean, and your input's very welcome. Any other questions for Mr. Barr?
No.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you a little later in the week on
a
different
you.
Subject matter.
So I might be able to assist on a couple of those questions.
Please do. All assistance is welcome at this
right.
point.
So the first, there were some questions on the NPS UDC. The more specific questions as to the zones that have been used, Ms. Hampson may be able to assist. On those questions, she's been heavily involved in the council's development, the models and their assessments. In terms of the question about what makes up the urban environment, ironically, I printed some submissions from 2017, which I presented to the panel in stage one, on that very question. I'm not sure why I did, but I did. And this, we addressed the very question you put to Mr. Barr, which was, how do you apply the NPS and the definitions in it to this particular district? Because it is probably one of the most complex in terms of the mountains and the lakes and the, you know, the urban areas and the settlements and the towns and so on. So just to briefly highlight a couple of those points. The first is that the NPS is triggered through the definition of urban area. Of course, Queensland Lakes District is a high growth urban area, and that particular definition takes you through to urban areas as defined by Statistics New Zealand from back in 2016. That's the starting point, but the definition of urban environment is a separate definition, and it is not linked to Statistics New Zealand data or boundaries. And what that means for this district is that, so that the urban environment definition specifically states irrespective of statistical boundaries. So if you look at the Waikato Basin to start with, the submissions that we wrote a few years ago were that, and I think they've been accepted in one of the panel's reports from stage one, were that the pattern of urban settlement is completely dominated by large mountains, lakes and rivers, making it somewhat complex in applying the NPS. Although not a concentrated settlement in the phrase's ordinary dictionary meaning, the urban environment of Queenstown is grouped around and interrupted by these natural features. The council considers it the most practical approach to what is presented by how Queenstown has developed in its particular physical geography is to treat the collection of areas that together function as a single urban environment as a concentrated settlement for the purposes of the NPS definition of urban environment. So taking that a step further, to then include the rural areas that happen to be in between, for example, Queenstown and Arrowtown, council has not taken that approach. potentially treating Queenstown and Arrowtown as acting and working as one urban environment?
I remember the public outrage from the good citizens of Arrowtown when the planning, when the hearing panel at stage one accepted that submission and suggested that Arrowtown was part of the Queenstown urban area.
Perhaps that wasn't the best example to use, but for the purposes of applying the MPS, I mean, it is a it's a national level document that we have to apply to this district. And the Environment Court through topic one has considered the MPS. It's considered it in the context of business land, and it's considered it in the context of residential land. And taken no issue with the approach that's been taken to defining the urban environment.
So in substance, your submission is the Environment Court has endorsed that view and we can rely on it?
Yes, I mean, to be fair, it wasn't a question in dispute before the Environment Court, but we presented briefs of evidence on the MPS, and one of the questions put to us very early on was, do the provisions that you're putting forward give effect to the MPS? So that's the question that we were tasked with. The second matter relates to your question about 3.3.8, and Mr. Barr was correct in that strategic policy wasn't appealed, which means that it wasn't a focus at the hearing. But what I can advise you is that similar worded policies were. That is 3.3.3, 3.3.6, and 3.3.10. And those policies use similar wording. They talk about avoiding new commercial zoning of land, avoiding additional commercial zoning that is likely to undermine, and so on. And then 3.3.10 is about avoiding commercial rezoning. The court had no issue with those particular policies. Judge Hassan's decision was released after Judge Jackson's decision on Bunnings, and Judge Hassan confirmed the wording that we have here on similar worded policies. Mr. Place also addresses this in terms of a lot of additional information is before this panel on the industrial zones, but I'll leave that matter to him later in the week.
Yes, and
just.
And we all know which judge is going to be hearing the appeals on this stage.
Yes. So, two other matters. First, you asked a question about Judge Jackson's comment in the consent order on the RPS. I was at the Judicial Settlement Conference referred to, and that you asked Mr. Barr about. All parties had no issue with the wording, so all of the parties were in agreement on that. And
yes, I got the message. There was only one person in the room who wasn't in agreement.
Yes. But, and Mr. Chair, you were spot on with the reason. It was because of when you apply King Salmon and what it tells us what to do, you have to apply words like avoid, and you can't get around that through some balancing approach. So without actually writing King Salmon into the RPS, which we don't want to start doing, all the parties didn't think that was necessary.
Thank you very much.
Just finally, you asked some questions about the objectives and which objectives you need to be considering. I do address that in my legal submissions, which I'll come to. Not right now, but I will come to that.
Indeed.
So that's all. So we'll call Ms. Pickard.
Indeed.
Good afternoon. So my evidence considers and makes recommendations on the submissions and further submissions of Chapter 39 and variations to the PDP making up the Wahitukuna proposal. Proposal identifies areas of value to mana whenua and provides for consideration of potential adverse effects on mana whenua cultural values as part of decision making. I consider that the proposal is an appropriate response to recognition of these areas and ensures the ongoing management and protection of areas of significance. Having considered the submissions and evidence, I recommend the following amendments. Minor amendments to further clarify and improve the expression of objectives and policies, including inclusion of identified in relation to wahitupuna when used throughout the provisions, refinements of the threats listed in policy 39212, reference to cultural values in 39213 and policy 39216. For the description of the Wahitupuna sites, the recommended amendments are the same as those set out in Appendix 1 of the evidence of Edward Allison. Amending the rules in relation to earthworks and farm buildings, which enable these activities to occur subject to meeting specific performance standards. This is based on the further clarification from Karunaka as to when these activities would adversely affect cultural values. Amending provisions to remove the urban areas within a wahitupuna from being subject to the rules of Chapter 39, Earthworks and Subdivision. I make this recommendation as the extent of modification to urban areas means that further development will have limited impact, as the degree of modification to date has been confirmed by Karunaka as having less sensitivity. I recommend that the urban environment be used to reference these areas, being those zones contained within Part 3, Urban Environment of the PDP, and open space and recreation zones within the urban growth boundary. Ensuring provisions are drafted consistently with other parts of the PDP, clarifications being provided in evidence of the circumstances where cultural values may be impacted by adverse effects of farm buildings, and as a result, the Section 42A recommended rule for farm buildings is now set out as a performance standard. My recommended amendments reflect this, where activity rules are now set out as performance standards. I consider that the recommended amendments to Chapter 39 are beneficial in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. The objective and supporting policies have been clarified and provide clear direction as to the identification of wahitupuna and how adverse effects on cultural values for these areas are to be managed and protected to give effect to policy 2.2.2 of the partially operative regional policy statement and section 6, 7 and 8 of the RMA. Key outstanding matters of disagreement between Karunaka and myself are the mapping of Takikarara, Tahuna and Te Karikari as set forward in the evidence of Okaha. While Okaha have advised that these areas are of cultural significance to mana whenua, representing these through mapping is beyond the scope of the proposal as notified in submissions. In addition, as I have recommended amendments to provisions that mean the rules are not triggered in the urban environment, I do not consider it necessary to include mapping of these areas. I do not consider that requiring notification of all discretionary and non-complying activities within the urban environment is appropriate. Policy 39212 and Schedule 39.6 sets out activities that may have the potential to adversely affect cultural values of mana whenua, and these provide direction for assessment of these for the purposes of notification when these activities require a discretionary or non-complying resource consent. Location of the glossary of te reo terms in both Chapter 5 and Chapter 39. I do not consider the duplication necessary and remain of the opinion that Chapter 2 remains an appropriate location for the glossary, and this aligns with the national planning standards as well. However, I consider that specific reference to the location of the glossary within the proposed Chapter 5 and Chapter 39 would assist in ensuring plan users are aware of the location of the glossary. The combining of policy 39213 and 39214, I'm neutral as to the combining of these two policies as suggested, but I do not see it as necessary. I consider there is sufficient clarity with two separate policies. Some recommended amendments from Mr. Bathgate results in the provisions applying more broadly than set out in the notified provisions. This includes amendments to policy 39216 and 3217. Where these policies are sought to apply to activities beyond the list set out in 39.21 and 39.22. I consider that broadening these policies beyond the activities specified would weaken them and could create uncertainty as to when cultural values require consideration. The amendments recommended by Mr. Bathgate to the matter of discretion in 25.716, as these matters relate to rules which sit outside of those applying to this proposal. Key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and submitters, other than Kai Runaka, who have filed evidence, are removing the wahi tupuna overlay from private properties or redefining the extent of wahi tupuna in the absence of confirmation of any amendments to the overlay directly informed by mana whenua. For example, there's been suggestion of inclusion of Lake Hayes and the Rendles were one such submitter who suggested that. Removing the requirement for resource consent where written approval is obtained, as recommended by Mr. Farrell. Locating provisions within each zone chapter of the PDP instead of district-wide chapter as proposed. I stand by my recommendations set out in my Section 42A report. Further amendments to provisions beyond what Ka Runaka have clarified as having potential to have adverse effects on cultural values of mana whenua. For example, amending the list of activities set out in policy 39212 and amending the elevation of where farm buildings and earthworks are enabled to an elevation other than 400 metres above sea level as confirmed by Ka Runaka. The amendments to exemptions to Chapter 25 and including functional needs of infrastructure as a matter of discretion as requested by Aurora.
Relationships and associations and identifying all of that aspects of the mana whenua. What involvement did yourself or council staff have in the drafting of the provisions?
So essentially I undertook drafting of the provisions, but it was always a collaboration with Okaha.
And the same query just regarding the identification of threats. Were there any involvement in that?
There was definitely discussion around understanding what threats might be and how that interacted with how activities were set out in the plan or how activities were defined in the plan.
So, Karunaka evidence has been really helpful in having provided some more detail on the mapping process, and I'm sure we'll have more questions for them later. But was council provided with a shape file or the GIS mapping was already done when it was received by
Correct. We received GIS file that we could then input into our system.
And were there any discussions after that or verification that some submitters have raised, well, we're hearing that the extent of the mapped areas is correct. There are some submitters that have raised issues with anomalies where pieces that are, I guess, left out or that seem to be a technical GIS, and I'm not savvy with GIS, so for a technical reason rather than a values-based reason. So did you work together to verify or test any of that aspect of it?
I suppose there wasn't specific testing, but there was certainly discussions that went on in terms of we received the file and sort of but nothing specific in terms of testing.
I guess from a planning perspective, just in this your summary that you've just read to us, I'm jumping all over. B, 4B, regarding written approval, about Wahi Tupuna overlay was the only reason why a resource consent was triggered. And written approval was obtained. What's the problem with what Ben Farrell is suggesting from your perspective?
My understanding of that is that there really isn't a mechanism to enable that. I know that some district plans do have those types of provisions in there, but it's always been a bit debated whether they are actually a process that's enabled through the RMA.
Commissioner, I think I think there are decisions since the 60s saying that permitted activities can't turn on the approval of a third party, including the city.
Yes.
Eton and Featherston's the one that keeps, that's about 1984.
Correct.
Like it predates the RMA.
Yeah. But there are some district councils that do still have rules like that I know of.
Yes, I can recall applying for consents for permitted activities from QLDC in the 1980s.
Central Otago has rules to that nature.
Sorry, Commissioner, please carry on.
The way they've been incorporated, I think in this latest version, they're listed in the schedule on Wahi Tupuna where there's an overlap and they coexist, and some submitters have raised issues around duplication. So I'm just wondering how that would work in a practical sense, but obviously there'd be a notification for statutory acknowledgement areas. But where there's an overlap, how do you see that working?
Well, certainly one of the things that was mindful of in looking at the provisions is that notification, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think it also talks about adjacent to statutory acknowledgement areas. in some of the context of the areas that we're talking about, you know, if you apply it, say, to an adjacent property, you could be looking at very large areas, because, you know, high country farm or something like that. So this provides an opportunity to actually provide a little bit more definition and recognition of the surrounding areas that may actually sort of be more properly adjacent, rather than just capturing, say, a whole property. You'll find that they sit separate. They are their own entity, but you will find that there are some crossovers. So I think they work together.
Wording, and there's just a few of these here. 39.2.1.4 and probably 39.2.1.6. Are you satisfied with how those read?
Yes.
Call a spade, should the of in the last full line of 39.2.1.4 be something like in respect of? Seem to be far too many ofs.
Just while on those two, and I throw a brilliant thing, it's the term cultural values. Cultural value slips in those two policies, but it's just values elsewhere. And I'm wondering whether the use of the term there is specific. What do cultural values mean as opposed to mana whenua values?
Well, cultural values in respect to what we're looking at is mana whenua values.
So I suppose the question I have is what is cultural at here? Because in your summary, you've referenced that cultural had been added to those, and I wondered why they had been, because I wasn't sure whether they added anything, or are they meant to add something different than values?
The intention was to try and keep it consistent.
I mean, if I could just say, in policy two, you've got values held by mana whenua.
Yes.
In policy three, you've got mana whenua values. In policy four, you've got cultural values of mana whenua. And that's coming in six as well. I mean, it isn't consistent.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It'd be nice if it was, because otherwise everyone thinks you mean something different in each one.
That was kind of where I was going with the questions. It seems that there's different languages used in different contexts, and I'm wondering whether they're meant to be all the same.
Certainly the intention was to try to go to consistency, but perhaps got a little bit
through.
Commissioner Cheatham. since everyone else seems to have...
Sorry.
Pardon.
Yeah.
I started it, so...
I'll let them carry on. I now need to go through and collect myself.
Can I start? Coming back slightly more broadly, so this, and I'm... There may be similar questions from other commissioners. Again, I'm happy if they come at the same time. So this chapter is called Wahi Tipuna, and it's got a purpose statement there, and part of that is through the identification of the areas. But when I come to the first or two day objectives, and certainly the first policy, they seem to take you much more broadly than certainly the identified Wahi Tipuna. And is that intentional? So the objective, the values held by mana whenua, comma, in particular those within the areas identified, are recognised, but it's not exclusive to those. And then the first policy is recognise those activities may be inconsistent wherever they may occur. So it seems it is broad, and is that intentional?
Correct, and that flows through from Chapter 5. There's some direction set out in Chapter 5 as to that there are... those specific activities wherever in the district, and then to have specifically identified areas of cultural values. And so this was intended to follow through from that direction set in Chapter 5.
Can I have a point of clarification? I think the Commissioner asked you a yes, no question, and
sorry.
You said he was correct.
Oh, sorry.
So yes, it is intended to go more broadly. Do you think that would be confusing to a planned user who might come to this provision to look at the identified Wahi Tipuna, but then and not pick up or pick up? Seems to be a much broader concept here, much more broader values. I'm not saying they're wrong, I'm just wondering whether they're placed correctly here.
I suppose I felt that the drafting provided sufficient clarification on that in terms of that two tiers, and particularly if you read it in conjunction with that Chapter 5, that you have some indication of it in Chapter 5, and then this sets it out.
So what you were saying to me is this chapter is not just about Wahi Tipuna. It's talking about much wider values held by mana whenua.
Correct.
Wouldn't you just want to change the title?
Yeah.
And perhaps the purpose. Because the purpose, you read the title, okay, it's about Wahi Tipuna, and then you dive into the purpose, and it immediately brings you just to Wahi Tipuna. And then it's not until you really start thinking about Objective 1 and Policy 1, you think, this is a bit wider than that. And I don't even know if I would have picked that up until I started reading your evidence, and
right.
Mr. Bathgate's evidence.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
So I suppose we just, those are the sort of questions I'm putting, and again, we'll ask it the other witnesses, but it's useful something to reflect on, I think. Just, can I continue, can I come back to the objectives? It might be answered, because if it is broader, because the value is held by mana whenua, and then there are a set of values in the schedule. And I think the values, and I suppose the question is, are the values that are set out in the schedule, they're specific to the Wahi Tipuna and not the broader values held by mana whenua? Is that how you see that? Is this where, when I was reading this chapter, when it first said the values, because I looked at the title, I thought, no, I went to the schedule, and there are values set out there. But when I bring it back to the objective, I think it's much broader. So those values, I suppose the question is in the objective, though the objective, the values is what we just discussed, are much broader. They are the broader values held by mana whenua for the district, not just in relation to the identified Wahi Tipuna.
Certainly the intention was that those were the values that needed to be considered in relation to the Wahi Tipuna for that 39212. Oh, sorry. Can you please repeat the question?
It might be a slightly redundant question, although the way you've answered it, I'm not quite sure, because if this chapter was to be renamed something more, to be broader, and then there were specific things coming into way, then I can see how that objective might work. My thoughts is that objective, I was confused by it under the heading of way to prune, because it's broader value set. Because it's not just referring to wahi te puna. Might be able to pull, I'm happy for you to come back a bit later if you want to think about that.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand how this all flows. Sim, do you want to come back? I've got others.
I had one about the 10 metres maximum volume, and so I couldn't quite find or have a look at the right page for what that means, and if that's percent of that. Sometimes you see numbers like that, and it's per earthworks, that's the total, or it's cumulatively over a season, or it's just for that property. So I don't know if you looked at, I think it was the Middleton evidence from Nick Eddie about the gates, farm gates, and how that would work out for them in a practical sense.
So certainly 10 cubic metres, 10 cubic metres is what applies in the likes of other sensitive environments like the ONF, and I can appreciate that the example given in terms of it probably wouldn't be practical for every single gate to require earthworks, but it's not unusual for there to be more sort of farm-based resource consents that might enable certain amounts, and you know, there could be appropriate conditions to make sure that cultural values are appropriately managed.
In a consenting, just taking that example further, how would they, if somebody like that apply for consent to that over what, a 35-year period or something like that, for multiple, how does that work out? How do you see that happening?
I suppose that would somewhat depend on operational requirements of a farm, which would be something that I'm not familiar with, but certainly you can apply for a variety of earthworks consents over a length of time that it would be, I suppose, somewhat dependent on anticipated works that might be happening, or that are known from previous operations.
Are you familiar with what the situation is like now at the council in terms of what sort of level of engagement with and resource consents with Mana Whenua is there at the moment? Is it quite common or rarely, or
I think it's becoming more common, but that perhaps hasn't been the case, that there's a shift to it becoming more common.
And that consultation or engagement that's becoming more common, does it frequently involve production of cultural impact assessments?
No. No, in most instances, it often results in email or letter.
What was that, sir?
No.
Smith?
Turn my microphone back on.
Commissioner, before you start, I think we're at afternoon tea time. We'll take a break. Hold that thought. We'll be back in 15 minutes. Thank you.